It's a great pleasure and privilege to have a chance to talk to Andy Hopper, whose name I've known for a long time, but we've never had a chance to meet, and is in charge of the computing laboratory, as he'll explain. So, Andy, where and when were you born?
I was born in Warsaw, in Poland, with Polish parents, and I went to primary school there, and I came to the UK in 1964, when I was just in the last year of this primary school here in the UK. So my parents divorced, and my mother met an English chap called Hopper, and we came and we live in the UK, in London, since. So I spent, that was January 64, and I went to local primary school. We lived in central London, and then went to secondary school and on from there.
Can we go just back? You were born in 1953, is that right?
53, a fine vintage.
Oh yes, the same year as Sir Richard Friend I discovered yesterday. Do you remember anything about your grandparents at all?
I do remember a bit about my grandparents, because I think my real parents didn't get on that well, so I, and my mother was working, so I was looked after by her, but really by the grandparents on her side. I'm not at all familiar with the family on the other side, so I spent quite a bit of time with both my grandparents, and so yeah, I remember them pretty well. But that, I mean, they're one of these families who were sort of middle class before the war and lost everything during the war, and ended up being all right, but were in sort of modest circumstances. Not bad, but not as they had previously.
What did they do? What was their occupation?
Well, my grandfather was an administrative assistant in a church, so he counted the dead.
Counted the dead?
Well, you know, you registered with him.
Oh, I see. Yes.
If you wanted to say you're getting married or getting divorced, or not divorced, sorry, getting
buried.
married, buried, or a new arrival. So he did that. And my grandmother, well, she was slightly older than him, 2 years older than him, and well, she had been part of the family printing business or something before the war, but after the war, I'm not quite sure, I remember 53, so by the time I remember anything is the late 50s. She was just part of the household and did her stuff at home. And so then I came to the UK in 1964, went to a primary school, St. Peter's Primary School, in just by Victoria Station. I couldn't speak English, and I hadn't taken the 11 plus, so getting to, and I was quite good at school in Poland, but here, what with the different system and the sort of class of a town of societies, particularly at that time, I ended up being rejected by all the private schools like Latimer and Westminster and all that. They wouldn't take a second look at me. I didn't have an 11 plus, not having taken it even. So I ended up going to a grammar school. But it was right across, we then moved fairly quickly to Putney, and the school was in St. John's Wood. So I ended up going for my secondary education to a school that was a grammar school and then became a comprehensive school when I went into my sixth form, and that was in St. John's Wood. So I would spend each morning and each afternoon, part of that time, going back and forth across London on the tube. So I know that kind of commuting well.
On your own?
On my own,
those
yeah.
were the days,
those
weren't
were
they?
The days, yeah. sometimes I had a free bus pass. Now Hopper, my stepfather, he's dead, but and he died almost exactly 30 years ago, 1978. About 2 weeks, 3 weeks anniversary kind of thing. He was a trader, so he had been to Poland to, I think he invented pickled baby beetroot or something, because second crop of the beetroot plant. So he was doing some business in Poland. That's how he met my mother. But he wasn't badly off. He wasn't a rich man, but he wasn't badly off. And as ever, property rather than trading beetroot was, anyway, he had some retail fruit and veg shops, and he was also a wholesaler of fruit and veg on Spitalfields Market, and therefore, you know, he made an okay living, and at various times in his life, I think he was relatively well off. But his first wife died, and he was a cradle snatcher, because I think he was 17, 18 years older than my mother.
Mm-hmm.
So when we came to the UK, my stepfather, I took his name, I took an English version of my Polish first name, and Drew rather than Andrzej. I retained my fluent Polish, and
to this day,
and that's because my mother would always talk in Polish whenever, at any granularity of time you like. William Hopper, my stepfather, wasn't in the room. So we got into this habit, and in effect she maintained my Polish because we would be using it as soon as he walked out of the room, and it just became casual routine, which I'm very pleased about, and as you can, some of the audience might be able to tell that I still have an accent, and this rather suits me. I like that for all sorts of reasons. Anyway, so went to school in London, and did okay at first, then didn't do so well. Then the school became comprehensive. And I guess it's just like vignettes in a thing like this. So there are two vignettes three vignettes I can give you, which relate to school. And I'll give them backwards. So the one that I remember in lower sixth is that they said to me, you're basically not very able, and you should really do an OND, Ordinary National Diploma, as they were then, not even a higher one, because, so that's interesting. The vignette before that was earlier, the school recommended, and I went to a applied psychologist who gave me a whole bunch of tests, and that formed their advice, so that psychologist.
Did he diagnose you with any known ailment or?
No, it's just they assessed me and they got it wrong. The reason they got it wrong is because they completely, I can't quite remember this part, they completely ignored my Polish cultural background in the test they did, and so I came up clay. Anyway, it doesn't matter. But so that was the second vignette, that's lower six. But I had said that there were times at school where I did well, so the first vignette, so to speak, chronological order would have been that when I hadn't done so well in the second year, Bill Hopper, my father, gave me a financial incentive to do better, and it went something like, you're 23 out of 30 in this class, I'll give you £10 or something like that for the first 10 places you go up, and then £2 for each place after that. I came first the following year, so I collected the whole shooting match. So I don't know if that was this. And, you know, he was a little bit business-oriented, even in schooling and, you know, the incentive and all that. So maybe that's a little indication of what was later on a little more business-oriented interest I've had. But anyway, the bottom line is I did okay, so I'm not one of these stellar in everything, couldn't go wrong. No, it's up and down like a yo-yo, in the measured stuff anyway. So up in Poland, down at first in secondary school here, then up in the middle of the secondary school, then down in the early part of the sixth form, then sort of halfway up to towards the end. I didn't get particularly good A-levels, and the school had gone comprehensive, and while that has a lot of merit, in fact, when I look back on it, not many went to university from that school. In the early part of my schooling, the grammar school was sending people to university, by the time it became a comprehensive and second year of comprehensive, that was much more unusual. Although actually, in retrospect, it was quite a okay school, really. Anyway, so I did mid-good, not stellar, but not bad, and I applied to university and ended up at University of Wales, Swansea.
Can I just go back over two things? One is your parents' character. I mean, that could have come much earlier, but it doesn't too much about your adopted, your mother's second husband, but was your mother someone who you were close to?
Yeah, reasonably close to. I mean, it's a Polish cultural background where you tend to be a little more sticky with each other. And I don't know about my real father. I believe he's some kind of academic. My mother, she's sort of a fairly ambitious woman with attitude, not particularly pushy in the sense of you got to do like this, but attitude, opinion and everything, you know, perhaps that formed a perspective. Education in that culture is very important. Achievement, attainment is pretty important. I guess that was...
The other thing I was going to ask you about your school, were there any subjects that you were particularly getting interested in?
Well, again, it's a mixed bunch of things. I've always enjoyed the more mechanical engineering trendsets, if you like, perspective of things. But in the school, it was good and bad. So some of the things I ended up not kind of being encouraged to have been a disadvantage. So they kicked me out of history very quickly. So my knowledge of straightforward kind of chronological or any other history for that matter is weak. And they put me into woodwork rather than something else, which I can't even remember what the choice might have been. So I just carried on, and it was fine in terms of pull onto subjects. The electronic side of things, the computing side of things, in the late 60s and very early 70s, I went to university in 71, so I would have been a sixth former 69 till 71. That was so just after landing on the moon, that was just starting to happen, and I clearly had some interest in that stuff. You couldn't, one couldn't get a computer at home at that time, so you had to go to university to do a computer, and in school you'd have had I did have sort of electronics kits at home, actually not at school, at home, where I fiddled around with that sort of stuff. So my educational context was not one where I would find a subject and then I'd be pulled up by the school or the circumstances. It was more jolly good, let's just get on with it, nice, keep going, and then interests as they came along, they kind of factored in as the parents best could and the school could, but they weren't sort of very privileged. And this has nothing to do with wealth, it's just the way it was.
Were there any teachers who influenced you particularly at the school? Or not
that I can recall. I don't think they were particularly bad or good or anything. They were nice enough people, as I recall, but it wasn't a... kind of fully engaged situation. I was commuting a long way, so that essentially none of my school friends were available nearby to where I lived.
What about sort of games or music or hobbies or?
Well, I was a cox at rowing, and they didn't tell me that in those days that would help get into a top university. It wouldn't today, but in those days. So the school was actually the old... The school was called Quinton School. It was set up by Quinton Hogg, who did the Polytechnic in London. And so it was a sort of Polytechnic school and had access to the Polytechnic's sports ground and rowing facilities on the Thames at Mortlake. So in terms of sports, there was a sports ground, there was tubs and rowing and coxing and all this sort of stuff. And as it happens, that wasn't too far from where we lived. So actually there was a little bit of a connection there. But I wouldn't emphasize that too much. I'm quite sporty. I like my sports, like many people. I was in for what it's worth, in both the University of Wales and this university's skiing team of all things. So it's not the most important or leading of sports, but nevertheless, I did a little bit of that sort of stuff over the years. And I'll come back in a minute about being a PhD student. But it sounds very bland. The main thing about my education from that point of view was central London. As I grew up, we had a good time. I had some friends. We used to go to discos in Soho. I used to get a bit of money for handing out tickets on the street. My friends in school were savvy London lads. Not East End, it's North London, even though I lived South London. And that was, very real world education. And the comprehensive school went as part of that. There were all sorts of people. There was not too far from Kilburn, so there's Irish, North London, Jewish people, some coloured skin, it's all kind of stuff. And that's quite good in a way. My children now go to the state system for similar sort of reasons. I think the school is rather better in many ways, Thorston Village College in my case, but I look at it as a much broader thing rather than a narrow, here is your subject, just get on with it. Now, whether some other existence would have been better, I have no idea, who cares? That's the way it was. And what it did set me up is at the time when computing was starting to get going in a sort of more popular level, less exclusive, more accessible level, it did set me up to apply to university. I applied to Manchester, I applied to Lancaster, I applied to Swansea. I didn't get the marks for Manchester or Lancaster, but I think it was C's I got, and I can't remember quite. But anyway, the professor at Swansea, I phoned up and I said, I think I've got one less than you offered. Will you take me? He said yes, and that was that. And as it turns out, that was fantastic. Mm. And the reason it was fantastic was because, one, it turns out I am quite okay at this computing, because ever since that day I've been top of everything in some broad sense. It suits me, and then it's easy to be, it's always got firsts after that, everything else just went straight through. So one is it suits my talents, and two, this guy, a fellow called David Aspinall, he was from Manchester himself, but he got his first year at Swansea. So he came along and set up a course called Computer Technology, and I'm Professor of Computer Technology, and Morris Wilkes, Professor of Computer Technology, and this is, name's the same, but it wasn't designed like that. But it's correct. So that course in Computer Technology was a combination of electronics, computer science, and a little bit of what now would be called enterprise, except then it was called a little bit of macroeconomics, read your Lipsy, a little bit of P&L accountants, it's what a balance sheet looks like, that sort of thing. And this is 1971. So this guy put together something which was, it's not quite joint on this, but a very appropriate course, which today is as, I don't think it exists anymore, but would be as fresh as you can imagine, and at an early stage in the subject's development where, you could, for the first time, get computers, but it was still, microprocessors just coming, that sort of stuff. So it was still early that it was all to do, all to discover, all to fiddle around, all to play with, all to everything, train sets. And that was fantastic. And then Gower, Swansea, wonderful, beaches. And then, socially, having been a London person, I didn't exactly find it difficult to have a good time in Swansea, because I wasn't a retiring chap from some more distant part of, or less experienced chap from some more distant part of the UK. I was a downtown London kind of person having a good time in Swansea. So that was very good, and I sort of trying to assess my perspectives a little. So I remember, for example, the year between. Was it that year or was it the year after? I think it was maybe between my first and second year. It might have been between school and first year. A friend of mine got a car, drove to Iran and back.
With you? To Iran.
Iran, yeah. So, you know, right across Europe, Turkey. He was Iranian, so we basically went to visit his family and then back. In the Shah's days. Next year I went off by myself and got myself to Brazil and toured by myself all over Brazil. So I was, you know, it was all good stuff when I think about it. And my son is 13, and just this week he's on his first trip in Germany with the school, but I'm thinking, God, he's behind the curve compared to me, how times have changed, and I'm sort of encouraging kind of perspective on this, but somehow all that seemed to be easier than that. So that should give you a little sort of compressed summary that I ended up being with the right course, in the right place, right course being suiting what I can do, and also it turns out a very good timely course for the way the world would turn out. It's a good launch pad, but rather different to Cambridge because I hadn't seen a gown till I turned up in Cambridge, nor a black tie, I think, or anything of that sort. Anyway, so I did that in Swansea, and then I flipped it into Cambridge because you know, I did well in my class at Swansea, but I was still this keen skier, so really what I was thinking about is how can I combine postgraduate studies, and I always had some idea that I would do postgraduate, that seemed to be a good thing to do, with skiing. So I was planning to go anywhere that's close to a big mountain.
So Cambridge was the obvious place.
So I didn't apply here at all. I could have done, by then, you know, my marks and all that stuff was okay. But I applied to Lausanne, I applied to Grenoble, and you know, I was hoping to go to one of those places. My French isn't too bad, so that wouldn't have been a particular inhibition. But I didn't hear anything from these people. So this Aspinall guy, who was the professor, my professor in Swansea, he said, well, it's getting on a bit. It's early July. And the timing of this comment to anybody that does admissions would be well understood. It's early July, you better apply because the UK SRC, as it was, funding system, you know, these things have been allocated, and unless you get one in the UK, it will be too late. Why don't you try Cambridge, he says. And Cambridge was a professional connection, but Manchester is the other sort of early centre in the UK of computers, and he wasn't in that first generation, but he was in the second generation of people who did computing in the UK, in his case in Manchester. I know this fellow called David Wheeler in Cambridge, and he'll be all right. He'll suit you well. Go and talk to him. I had a little car there, and so if I went driving down here, we're in Cambridge, to Cambridge in the early part of July 1974, and knocked on the door, so to speak. Well, I had arranged an appointment, but they said, okay, come in. And I had an interview with Maurice Wilkes and Roger Needham, with a couple of my savvy London friends, who I've kept in contact with to this day, having a cup of tea in Rose Crescent. And then the next day after that interview, they took me in. I would like to think that it was through great brain power and brilliance, but I fear the reality is that they actually had studentships and somebody had dropped out. And so they had a spare studentship going. So basically the next person walking in through the door who was half capable, they would have offered it to me. So they offered it to me, I said, yes, thank you very much, and that's a life sentence. So you know, so in a sense it's fluking it, but who knows, you know, there it is. So that's how I ended up in Cambridge. And I duly actually did get some offers from these other places near mountains, but by then I had limited and all the rest of it. Of course, Cambridge is a good place, and I was slightly bemused, scratching my head slightly, but anyway, it turned out that you know, I'd ended up here. But there we are. So I came here in 1974 and started my PhD. And I'm still wearing short trousers, but the computer, and this was at the computer lab with David, well, actually Roger Needham initially as my supervisor, but that was a default setting, and then David
Wheeler became my supervisor in the Easter term of 1975. But there are sort of little connections which I could make, vignettes again. So first of all, well, actually just factual, that the computer lab has had a tradition of building things, and they were actually at a stage where they weren't building anything. All the PhD students were doing this, and I turned up and I said, I liked a bit of soldering. So they set me up with a little actual hardware bench, and everybody felt a little happy because a little happier because it sort of this little morsel came up and was doing something that had its roots in the computer lab's earlier thing. So yeah, people said, oh, very nice, a PhD student solders doesn't just do this. So that was good. Then secondly, I had a ski instructor's ticket license. So actually, I did two things. I went skiing and I disappeared off, I seem to recall, for December and January of that year. So that, they found that a little bit odd. They were all very nice about it, but I was ski instructing in the Alps. And then the other thing I started doing was gliding. So in the autumn of 74, I went to the Cambridge University Gliding Club, which was at Duxford, and started doing all this sort of stuff. And, you know, I've carried on flying ever since. So there we go. So that's how I got into Cambridge. That's how it all got going. And that's how, on the Cambridge ring you mentioned, so that was one of the projects that I have done in the past. My main one is a PhD, but I was just the boy on that. I mean, that was done by David Wheeler, Maurice Wilkes, Roger, others. I did my bit, but I was a PhD student. And,
is that what your PhD was about?
Yeah, well, we were doing, I say, I was doing it in a PhD student sense, rather perhaps more opinionated and thinking that I was making a bigger contribution than I was, but nevertheless, helping to the basic design, and that was in the days of no local area networks. So it was, let's design a local area network, in other words, a faster network that can connect these machines. Morris and David Wheeler set out the design. I helped to finesse various bits. Ethernet was just coming along. We hadn't heard about it at first, but then they published a paper, and we thought, that's rather important. Similar sort of idea done in a different way. And my PhD was, as it's called, Local Area Computer Communication Networks, plural. So it was, I made the observation, I guess, that there are a great number of similarities in all these networks, and we can argue the detail, but actually you can design and implement them in, you know, with the same sort of hardware. And then I came up with it's a paper design, although it turned into better things later, for a single chip, so a one chip and a chip level implementation of any of these networks using this proposed hardware. So my thesis wasn't the Cambridge ring, because that wasn't, it was, look, Cambridge ring, here's my contribution, but now you sort of try and broaden that design process and so on. So that was 1970, that my 3 years were up, but what happened was these were sort of good times, and this idea of a single network chip for all these networks was, even at that point, I'm not quite sure, Ethernet had just been published, but they were obviously working on a chip and so on. That was a good idea. So again, the way I became a research assistant is, well, it's chance, sort of chance. Anyway, so I was going around explaining to many people how the Cambridge ring worked, because there was a lot of interest in it, and I guess Morris and Roger and David Wheeler got bored with doing it. So I would be the sort of gaffer who would do that.
And you came to our department, into our basement, and set it up for us.
Yeah, yeah. Well, because we had the big fiber, long fiber link that GEC gave that went across from the computer lab in the museum site over to Yonek of the woods, and then the cable would go down the stairs and over along down there, and over grovelling around there, making the interface work and all that sort of stuff in such anthropology, yeah.
It was a Nova, I think. It was a Nova.
Nova, that's right.
A Nova computer. It wasn't a PDP-11, as I recall. Nova, which was slightly unusual one to have.
Mm.
Oh, yeah. So, but as I was cruising around talking the talk, I bumped into one of the senior people at the Rutherford Labs. And basically, this person, David Thomas is his name, he said, how about me giving you some money to do this? That is, take this chip thing beyond your PhD. Oh, I said, so I turned up back at the computer lab, went to see Morris. I said, Morris, I just met this chap. And he says, have some money, and why don't you work on this? So Morris thought about this, I guess, for about a microsecond, and thought, oh, what a splendid idea. So essentially, I turned up with my own money, so to speak, to carry on as a research assistant. So then I carried on as a research assistant on this money, doing this chip, and then that developed. There was a Department of Trade and Industry, or whatever it was called then, a thing called the Advanced Computer Technology Scheme, which was basically a funding scheme, which again put some money into this. And I had a little management board which was managing me as a research assistant. So in other words, I didn't finish my PhD in 77, my time was up. I finished it in Easter 78 because I started doing some of this other stuff. And then Hopper died, which is why I remember it, in June 78. So I didn't actually take my PhD till September 78. Hopper had a heart attack and conked out in his chair in Putney, where we lived. But that's, yes, it's 30 years, just about now. So that's how I got into both Cambridge as Cambridge University as my employer. And I guess 31 years are up on the old pension. And got into this business of doing chips, and got into this business of doing networks. And that's kind of, those were good times to do it. Although again, it's competitive. One thinks, oh, good times, early days must have been easy. Well, no, because the competition was Ethernet in the shape of three companies, DEC, Intel, and Xerox had got together. So there was me over here, my little management committee, and there was Intel, Xerox, and DEC, and actually three commerce startup that Bob Metcalf did over there. So it was competitive, but nevertheless, in retrospect, as compared to today, where what you do in university as a computer technologist is a little more challenging to work out, appears to be anyway. That caused a bunch of technology to exist in Cambridge, which later on it became a variety of companies, all kinds of things. But the roots go back to that. And essentially, if I can summarize that, this is kind of important in an archival record point of view, is because these chains aren't obvious, but the chain goes as follows. So, Computer Lab's doing the Cambridge Ring, the first time local area networks are sort of starting to be done. Chip version, let's find somebody to make a chip. Okay, we happen to use Ferranti, or let's use Ferranti. They got some hardware but don't know how to design it. So we try and design it essentially by hand and go, oh, we need some tools. We need some CAD, computer-aided design tools, to make these chips. Let's have a CAD project. Okay, so we start a CAD project, which is making the tools, which will make the ring chips. Fine, we carry on with that. Meanwhile, companies are starting home computing, so CPU Limited, which is what Acorn was a trading name, essentially, until it became a public company. So a consulting and then a home computer company called CPU starts and says, ooh, let's use some of these chips, and there aren't any tools, but we can make a better computer at a cheaper price by using these chips that are the same as used in a computer lab for the RAIN. Ooh, that's a good idea. So the BBC Micro having chips inside it is rooted in that directly. And Sinclair as competition is also, well, it's just as a result of competition, but it's the same chips that were in there. So it's not that there was a technology flow. which is why they were a little bit behind us, but not much, in the technology sense. And then the BBC Micro had a network in it. It wasn't the ring, it was another network, but that's directly, again, rooted in this university work, because I network was a bit I had a lot to do with on the Acorn machines. So slightly different, but actually was the best of both worlds. It was a low-cost implementation of an Ethernet, but using some of the experience from the RAIN. And file servers and so on. So that whole system, and by that system I mean the BBC micro networking computer system and networking system, had networks in it. So when Bill Gates came along, we showed it to him, he said, "What's that?" We said, "A network." He said, "What's that?" You know. So we were ahead of the curve, for example, with respect to him. Okay, and then the being plugged into the world design cluster, if you like, or system, we is Acorn.
You were one of the founders of Acorn.
Co-founders, that was the third one. So there were two.
Herman Hauser.
Herman Hauser, Chris Curry, and me. But I'll explain that.
Right.
They're the three shareholders and the three directors of CPU, which is actually the underpinning company. But in Acorn, we started doing a microprocessor design, which has now become ARM, A-R-M, the world's largest supplier of microprocessors to mobiles, and like 90% share. But backtrack, so in Acorn, we needed CAD, so we purchased the CAD from the university that was being done as part of that.
Was that CAMCAD?
No, just CAD for chips, because we had that project, if you recall. I mentioned that we had the project for this, because the Ferranti thing couldn't be designed, so then we did some CAD. So Acorn purchased that, developed it itself, and that gave it its underpinnings to be able to design a microprocessor in the first place. So that's where that came from. And now ARM is super, ultra, mega successful. And then another, I'm sort of fast forwarding, but these are important lines. Then another Cambridge successful company called Virata, which is now much later in the 90s. But again, that's a networking company, DSL, the digital subscriber for the home, broadband to the home, chip company. But again, it's a networking company that uses a chip for its implementation. That's, you know, the next lower cost chip that went gangbusters and had about 40% of the world's DSL market for those sort of chips. And again, that's a direct, there were some higher speed networks in between, one or two bits of technology, but it's a direct line of technologies. So that whole business of just going back to the roots of the ring, chip for ring, a single sort of perspective on all networks of that kind can be done one way or another, and then jinking that into, you know, like businesses, but, you know, sort of high-tech ventures of various kinds, whether for the Acorn, whether for Virata, whether for ARM, actually even wireless is another line where it's more recent. That all has its roots in all that stuff.
Amazing. It's the spring from which so many rivers have flowed. Yes. I was just, before we go on along those lines, you mentioned several distinguished computer scientists, and it's always nice to have a vignette of them as well. Let's start with the oldest one, perhaps Maurice Wilks.
He is my professor. Well, David Wheeler and him are my professors, David Wheeler in the supervisor sense, and Maurice in this sort of slightly grander version of my professor. He carries on relentlessly, and to my amazement, with only a brief gap, his relationship, professional relationship with me, goes back to 74, so that's 34 years, crying out loud. and that, you know, he was just before retirement when we started. So he still comes in, he's still got the office next to me in the computer lab. When I was running the industrial lab, Olivetti Research Limited, he had his office next to me there, he participated in that. And the man is driven. So we all have this disease of hunger for success, for impact, for continual desire to achieve something with proper intellectual basis and all that. And he's the extreme version, so I refer to him in the kindest possible way I can, but I call him my intellectual dentist, because, you know, to this day he drills. And it's good for me, I know, but it hurts a bit. And you can't talk about football with the man, right?
But he'd already, as you say, he was nearly near retirement, and he'd already, there's a moot point, but been in charge of the first successful working programmable computer, EDSAC. So he was a very famous figure already when you came
very
to...
Very much so. I mean, he was a demigod, and he's even more of a demigod, and he's got every prize and so on. But it's just curious that... So I came in 74, he retired in 1980, so he was 61, I guess, or 59 or something, I don't know what time. 61, I guess, 67 he would have retired. And what, 34 years later, he still comes in, says, excuse me, Andy, but what do you think about, you know, fix on something technological? And I go, oh, gosh, and, you know, I have to bootstrap myself up and think about it. And I said, I'll come back to you about that, Morris, because he wants a proper answer. He doesn't want this, this off-the-cuff stuff. And I think about it, have a quick little read, talk to my friends, and I say, Morris, my view is this, right?
What about the Needhams, Roger and Karen?
Roger and Karen, yeah. Roger was part of the distributed system work on the ring. Of course, he did many other things before I started to do my little bits and pieces in Cambridge. So, from my telescope, it starts there, but obviously there were other things. Well, he's a great systems guy, and somehow he can. It's a combination of philosophy, logic, and parallelism, and optimization, and he's able to hold all this stuff in his mind and optimize. A good leader, very good leader. He had his effect on me. Karen, a little more distant, although I've had much more to do with her until she died just recently, because she was on my case as head of department in fundraising. And that was a very good thing to have, because she kept on saying, why aren't we doing this, why aren't we doing that, the foundation, and she personally made contributions as well, so that, before that was going, made the first foundation contribution to our fundraising campaign. So, and then she was a trustee of various things like Triplo Trust, which is Swinnerth & Dyer, and they, that trust has made a contribution. So, you know, that's my immediate memory of her. And then the more general memory of what she did was help a great deal with this very important computer lab thing, which is the breadth of the place. Now, people talk about interdisciplinary things, and I've taken to saying the department is interdisciplinary, because it is, in today's language, it's just so broad. And she was an FBA, we always used to say how wonderful it is that in the computer lab we've got fellows of the Royal Academy of Engineering, Royal Society, and the British Academy, right? Jolly, jolly good, a bit unusual. And that's the breadth, that's the interdisciplinary. And so I think of her as... for example, doing the language stuff, and some of it I understood, and then she went off into lands which I didn't understand, but it was very good that she was part of the computer laboratory. And the two of them, of course, were quite good sparring partners, and they wouldn't hesitate or feel embarrassed about having a robust discussion
The name she kept seems somehow symbolic, Spark Jones.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And so they were, you know, so I'm not sure about vignettes, but I remember moments when Roger got his chair, we had a great party, and everybody was very happy. And of course, he went off to do Microsoft, and since I used to run an industrial lab for many years, that was interesting as well, and we talked about how to run a lab. The Microsoft situation was different. Mine was a much more independent entity, less corporate. His was a little more corporate.
This is Olivetti.
This is Olivetti. But nevertheless, there were, you know, we would talk about how to run a lab and compare that, our perspectives to people who, to the digital and Xerox PARC and other places, distinguished labs, and how we might, you know, achieve even more than they did and sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. And what about David Wheeler as the last, your supervisor?
Well, I saw rather a lot of him because he was my supervisor, and, you know, you build up a bond with your PhD supervisor in a way not to with others, or at least it's a special bond. So he was, well, for the first year, it didn't matter how I went skiing because I couldn't understand what the guy was talking about anyway. So it was such a gap between what I could offer and where he was in the sense of training, you know, just his background, having done major bits of the EDSAC and the programming bit and all that. So that whole raft of experience, and therefore getting to the point of him, me posing a question, him giving an answer, me not understanding the answer, and then working out the whole context which made for the answer, took some time. I eventually did it, and then eventually I could talk his talk, right? So I didn't need all that time to work it all out, but I'm saying it took me a year, really a year, to do it. He was very, very smart cookie, so you know, he was good at the details, so he could normally the supervisor can't out-detail the student, but he could out-detail me. You know. Used to scribble on little sheets of paper, yay big. So David Wheeler scribblings, and in our archives, in my personal archives, I got some of that stuff. And he always felt there was already a bit of paper for everything you could conceivably ever ask, if they scribbled on and give you the answers. And there's some truth in all that.
He worked with Peter Swinnerton Dyer, didn't he?
That was before my time, but... so he was very special, and it would be difficult in the new world today for somebody like that to exist, because promotion, recognition, distinction are more formulaic these days.
He was just a lecturer, was he?
He became a professor, but you know, he was an FRS and published about three things in his time, so... maybe it's still possible. I was really thinking more of the university system. It would be more difficult for him to be a professor these days. Probably possible, but that would be too bad. But then, I would have a barbecue at home sometimes, and he would turn up on the back of his daughter's motorbike, and his daughter wore black leather, so that was always a little amusing thing.
You could talk about football.
Well, yes, there was no sort of territories. It's not that with Wilkes there were no go territories, there was just nothing to talk about, whereas with Wheeler, he didn't know much about it, but he could talk about it, say, motorbike, broom, broom, Hells Angels, whatever it was. I can now visualize those moments when he would turn up my drive on the back of his daughter's bike.
Tell me more about your flying, because that's obviously meant a lot.
Yeah, well, flying is... So I started that gliding thing when I was a first-year PhD student, and did a fair amount of that, and that takes a lot of time. So I really didn't do much PhD studenting between my skiing and my gliding. But I like that sort of stuff. I have very good spatial awareness and very good spatial and geographic, if you like, physical geographic memory. Very, very strong, and extremely strong sense of direction, and I like tinkering with things, and I quite like mechanical things. So if you put all that with flying, it matches rather well. So, because an aeroplane, it's got mechanical systems, it's got electrical systems of various kinds, it's got hydraulic systems of one or several kinds, it's got oxygen systems, it's got an engine, it's got fuel, it's got vacuum, it's got pressure, it's got, so you can fiddle up to a point. You mustn't over fiddle because you get into trouble yourself, but so that's good. Then the weather and all that plays a part. So all these things are very attractive to me. And so the trouble with flying is it's pretty expensive, so you gotta make a few bob, because on a research assistant, or dare I even say professorial salary, you can't do it. So fortunately I've made a few bob so I can afford it. And yeah, so I am as professional as I can about my flying. I've just under 5,000 hours flying experience right now. So that's for a punter, that's quite high.
You fly a Cessna, is that right?
I fly a small Cessna, single engine Cessna, with 6 seats. So it's on the bigger side of small aeroplanes, but it's still small. I forget it.
And you've got a runway at your house.
Yeah, I've got the airstrip at home in Little Shelford.
Mm.
So it's essentially a piece of grass which is 600 yards long.
Mm.
And, you know, you start pedaling at one end and you...
I've probably seen you up there from time to time.
But you'd be surprised what you can do. So there's particular... So it goes regular rating, then you can have an instrument rating. So if you've got an instrument rating, you can fly bad weather, good weather, at night, during the day. And then even with small aircraft, mine is really at the small end. But it's about the largest you'd want on a grass strip with safety. Mm-hmm. So it's really, you know, the two things go together. Otherwise, your plane gets bigger, you have to keep it at a bigger airfield.
Mm.
And if you haven't got an airstrip at home, that's fine. But if you've got an airstrip at home, the idea of having an airstrip at home but then going to an airport is slightly odd. But with my one, you know, it's got various sort of features, turbocharging and so on. So you'd be surprised. I can take off, and you know, I can go to Poland, for example, straight from home, no problem. And in Poland, also sometimes in a small place rather than a big place, and that works fine. And in my travels, which I like very much, so I've done quite a bit. So I like it. It's adventure travel I do. I don't do aerobatics, and I don't do racing, but I do adventure flying, by which I mean you travel. It's, you know, like the rough guide to flying the world, kind of thing. And there's a great thing about flying, which is, you'll appreciate this as a anthropologist, is that so you've got to land and you go somewhere, and normally it's small, and you're just much entertainment for them as they are for you. So you go to some place and they go, and you've got to land and talk to somebody, because you know, there's a little airfield and there's somebody minding it and so on, and you can't ignore that, and that's great. So they look at you and kind of immediately want to know what you're doing there, why on earth, and what's going on. But that means you can start talking to them, and they normally have a bit of English, or quite good English, we've got. So you can gel with people, and these are out-of-the-way places, so this entertainment is quite attractive for them. So that means they point you, they help you, and so on, just by the circumstances. So, for example, I've flown all over the Arctic, and the whole of the Arctic is like that. So you go to some little place in northern Canada, and when I say northern Canada, I mean northern Canada, I don't mean just north of the border, I mean 500 miles from the North Pole. In that case, it's military or a Canadian weather station, and they go, hello, we've been here 3 weeks, where have you come from? Greenland. What? And off you go. So I've traveled in that sort of way, and I like it. I've had the good fortune to be, for example, all over South America in my plane, all over Africa in my plane, to the States probably a dozen times, Canada, all over Canada, everywhere, all over Europe, all over. So with a bit of luck, I'll take it to New Zealand because we're going for 3 months in New Zealand next year. So you know, it's adventure flying. But when I say Africa, that means you. So if you take, say, Namibia, that means you fly the Skeleton Coast, 700-800 miles at 50 feet all the way down, right? pictures, seal, shipwreck, kudu, animal. Mm. 2 hours later, it's still getting. All right, it's that sort of stuff.
Fascinating.
And then because I do comms, and I've got all the comms in the world, so I can always phone my mum. I've got all the connectivity out of there you could ever wish for. So in terms of getting the weather, in terms of contact, but from a safety point of view and just social point of view, it's all there. So it's not heroic in any way, it's just right.
You read Flight to Arras?
No, I haven't.
By Saint-Exupéry, which is on the sort of meditative philosopher during the Second World War. It's a very beautiful book. He wrote Le Petit Prince, but this I think is an even better book. I think you'd enjoy it. In Penguin or something. Flight to Arras by Saint-Exupéry. That almost converted me to flying. Talking of long distances, you won't have flown there, but there's a lot happening, and I spend time in Japan and China and India. Do you spend any time in those parts of the world?
I haven't spent any time at all, really, in India. I'd like to. Just the way it's turned out. China a little bit more. But with the fast changes, and it's really on a business basis, although I've been on a lecture tour with some in China with some friends like Gabriel Horn.
I briefed him on that tour.
And Tom Blundell. But my experience of China is from a business perspective, where one or two of my companies have tried to sell in China. And, you know, with China, it's... cultural gap is, for me anyway, so great that whenever I think I understand what's going on, I immediately pinch myself, because obviously I'm hallucinating or dreaming of God myself, because it's all going to be changed, this is a mirage. So I haven't gelled with China in any substantive way, although I've been there quite a few times. I went there when I got married, because my wife is Alison Smith, she's professor of plant biochemistry here. That was nice. 1988. I went to China first time in 19. I went on a little round the world trip in between being a PhD student and a research assistant. 1977 when it first opened. Anyway, Japan, that's rather more frequent over the years for one reason or another. And there the cultural gap I find is still at least I don't have to pinch myself in the sense of reminding myself that I understand nothing. At least I feel I've got at least the beginnings of engagement with the Japanese. But at the moment, I'm developing links with Africa, actually. At the moment, in my own work, and this might interest you, and you might tell me how I'm getting this wrong, but the good times, in the sense of arrogant times with technology, have moved on. And so, everybody takes what the kind of things I do and others like me do for granted. That'll just carry on, that it's all fine, this technology will continue, and so on and so forth. And that may not be the case, but at the same time, more and more people are encompassed by it and actually have a view, and maybe even, and I use the word advisedly, need the technology to maintain their standard of living or develop their standard of living without affecting the planet in as substantive ways as predecessors, in other words, us, have done. And so I'm building links for non-charitable reasons, for professional business reasons, with Africa, actually. Because, shortly, in about a month's time, I'm off to Cape Town, I'm off to Kampala. And the reason to build it, they're all personal links. I've had a policy of trying to admit PhD students from the developing world for some time. They have to be good enough, but then I'll sort of. So I've got a fellow from the Cameroon, who's actually done well, he's just got a research fellowship at Trinity, but he's got an interesting perspective. Tanzanians, Kenyans. So they have to be professionally very good, but then they give a perspective on these technologies. So, for example, you know, you say, "Oh, here you guys in Africa, in some part of Africa, you getting this mobile infrastructure. We're going to design a nice, cheap, robust phone for you." You tell that to them, they say, "Bugger off! Last thing we want is a special phone for Africa, which is robust and cheap. We want the very latest Nokia model, because if there's one thing I want to be able to afford, and it's nothing else, I want to have the best Nokia phone. Get lost." And so that, that's more sort of design, social perspective, but now that filters through an engineer coming back at me saying, "Look, you're being a Wozzeck having this engineering perspective." They take it for granted, they assume the technology is coming and they want it like this, and unless you have it like this, you're going to be a loser. It's very important, even though I think the technology isn't necessarily coming and it isn't necessarily driven like that, but actually in today's world, to get it accepted and to satisfy my desire for impact, I need to have that. And then also it's a good excuse to travel. And Africa's great because there's no jet lag, so you know, I prefer that than anything like this. I've just come back from the US, and it's just, you know, yet again, jet lag. So you know, that's the core reason for
Africa. So that's a nice reason, yeah.
Yeah, it's realistic.
Do you know Neil Turok's work on setting up mathematical institutes in AIMS, African Institute for Mathematical Sciences? And they've just had 5 Africans brought through this program. Well, you'll see it on the website when his interview goes up, but it might tie in with your interests. Tell me something about the various companies which you set up and the technologies behind those. That would be fascinating.
Well, first company I was involved in with Herman Hauser was a company that sold the Cambridge Ring. So there were 4 companies that sold the Cambridge Ring altogether, and ours was one of them. And that started around the same time that CPU, the company that most people know as Acorn, started as well. And very quickly, that was started by Herman and Chris Curry. But they were in the same place, as I recall, in Market Square. And we amalgamated those companies into one very quickly. So I wasn't quite depends what you mean by founder or startup of Acorn. Acorn's the wrong name, it was CPU, and then CPU was a combination of Orbis, this previous company, and CPU. So fairly quickly, there were the 3 of us, we were shareholders. I was the smallest shareholder, very much smaller than the others, and there we go. That Orbis company sold the ring, did quite well, but we stopped selling the ring because we decided doing home computing is better, and so I concentrated on the chips for those machines and the networks for those machines and switched into doing stuff for the home computer company rather than the ring company. Although the other company selling Cambridge Rings did okay, and that whole thing lasted for quite some time, and it was okay. So Acorn did very well, and then did less well, and then Olivetti came along and took a majority stake in Acorn. And I was one of the directors, and they asked me to start an industrial research lab for them directly, rather than working in Acorn. Well, there was a little slither of time in between them coming and making that proposition. I started another company, which was a company called QDOS, QUDOS, Quick Design on Silicon, not a bad name. And that was a company that had some CAD software, CAD software for designing chips, and was actually a manufacturer of simple chips by using electron beam prototyping, by direct writing onto a surface each chip one at a time. That joined the living dead. It still exists and is based at Rutherford Labs. And that could have been a spectacular success, but not every one of your companies is a spectacular success, and that one wasn't. And the thing that we missed is that the hardware side, making the chips, was a very capital-intensive business and quite hard, and the volumes weren't there because you wrote each one at a time, and so the margins would have to be much higher on each chip, and you didn't, you know, so that didn't work out. The CAD side of the business could have gone gangbusters global, but we didn't prioritize that, and that's called a company called Cadence, nothing to do with us, but there we go. But that was 1985, if I recall correctly. So there was Orbis, Acorn / CPU, QDOS, and then Olivetti Research Limited. And Olivetti Research Limited was set up as a separate company, so yeah, the budgets came from Olivetti much of the time, but it was a separate operating company. I was the CEO, and it's the only time I've been a CEO. And this is all in parallel with doing my university thing, where I was an assistant lecturer, reader, professor, all the usual sort of things.
no particular accommodation by any of those processes for all this other stuff. I think if I might put it this way, in terms of my academic pals here in Cambridge, I'm the sort of most industrial parallel one. So when I've started something, I've gone with it and done it for a reasonable length of time, rather than designing the technology and launching it and leaving it to others. So Olivetti Research Lab went, I would say anyway, very well. But Olivetti started doing not so well, and so we decided we better do something about returns, otherwise we're going to be dead. So why don't we started spinning out companies, and so it's a very important change, which is very appropriate today, but anyway, times have moved on, the world is different, where you get some research, you do the research, you assume that your team is good enough, so you have something that's exemplary, the best in the world, whatever. You then offer it to the sponsor, the business unit. If they don't use it, then you do something else with it, but they get a cut of whatever the else is. So the cascade goes, you spin out a company with external capital, so you find some money, spin it out, and the original company gets a cut of it. If that doesn't work, you try and license it. And if that doesn't work mean you're actually too busy doing everything. So it all works, except you can't do everything all at the same time. Mm. So you're doing all these things in parallel. Then you open source it, or you keep it going in some way, because technology is all about, sort of some kind of analogy with boxing. You know, you get the next round and you do different weights, and it might be a bantam weight contest, it might be a heavyweight contest, but you want to keep going because you might still knock out the bugger in the next round, rather than saying I give up, right? Mm. So open source or some other method of keeping it going, and not putting it on the shelf and not hoarding technology not to be used, in other words, putting it into the dustbin, is very, very important. So we fell into that sort of cascade of maximizing opportunity by doing all this stuff. And at the same time, we started getting other sponsors for the research in addition to Olivetti. And this was not competing with the university. I said to everybody who worked for me, and there were up to about 60 of us, that's quite big. If you want to be academic, you can do the same thing as I do. You can simultaneously do your academic thing, but then you have to do it in the university, because we're not competing for good reason with the university. We don't pretend to be the university of anything. We're a more funky downstream applied lab with actually more resource. And that's what we do. So anyway, that worked very well. And then Digital Equipment Corporation funded us, Oracle funded us, and quite a few suitors, and eventually Olivetti sold the company to AT&T, and we became the AT&T lab. So the companies were Olivetti Research Limited, then what became Virata was the first spin-out, then at Telemedia Systems, which still exists, which does software which would help you with this particular problem, which helps with fast editing of multimedia material, and all this sort of stuff, producing different versions of it. Then there was a wireless company which was called Adaptive Broadband, that were all spun out of that industrial lab. So it's Adaptive Broadband is the next one. Then Adaptive Broadband spawned Cambridge Broadband, which is another wireless company of which I was chairman for quite a few years. That happened in 2000, that company started. And then the industrial lab was shut by AT&T in 2002. And that's very bad news and very good news. So the very bad news is that it was completely unnecessary, and I had two people who wanted to buy it, and the whole thing shouldn't have happened, but which is being trashed by an American owner. The good news is it completely carries on as companies, of which I myself have three at the moment. Four at the moment, to be precise. I'm chairman of three and director of the fourth just at the moment. But there are others. Because the projects within that industrial lab were good and strong, and the teams were strong. It's all about people, and the people have stuck together. And again, it was non-competing with the university, that there was a great premium on the teamwork in that place, and recognition of teamwork, and rejection of individual. You could do individual stuff, but it was a team play place. That was one of the advantages you could do. So it became a dozen companies. in Cambridge, and we still meet and we still have drinks, and we just had our anniversary, and you know, my PA still organizes it, and you know, everybody looks a bit older, but it all carries on. And so, but my three companies, as opposed to this diaspora stuff, there is a company called Will BNC, which is a software company. There's a company called Ubisense, which is a location technology plus software company. There's a company called Solarflare, which is a 10 gigabit Ethernet chip company. And they in turn have children now, so there's another company called Eventic, which I'm chairman, which is another chip company. And then I'm on the advisory board of yet another one of these children companies, and I've invested a bit in that. So it's about a dozen at the moment that I've directly done myself and been a director and co-founder, and then indirectly, God knows how many, whole mafia out there of this stuff. And it's still pretty tight, and there's a culture, and it does go back to Acorn, but it also goes back to this Olivetti lab, because that actually lasted rather longer than the kind of Acorn culture in its own way. It came from that. The Olivetti lab lasted 16 years, so yeah, it was, as I say, not a bad size for a research outfit. So that's my lot. And of bottom line, if you want sort of some kind of summary, the good news is some have done well. So Acorn did very well, went public, and you know, had a very nice valuation for a while. Virata went public, that had a very high value. You know, at the peak it was 5 billion, and I think 50, we counted millionaires in Cambridge on paper, just in Cambridge. So that was good. Some joined the living dead, nothing wrong with that. And some are at the races. And who knows? And the ones in play right now, well, again, they're a very motley lot of wonderful companies. And what I'm talking about is the diversity of each one. So, for example, the 10 gigabit Ethernet chip company has over $120 million of venture capital funding. So this is a huge amount of money, and this is going, you know, all or nothing, in terms of a real mainstream product called a 10 gig Ethernet chip, which will eventually end up not quite in a camera, but you know, in mainstream platforms. And you know, again, I can give you the whole technology chain of why that has a position, but it's the capital chain that's interesting, that is that much money, and most of it from the West Coast. Ubisense, this tag plus location tag plus software company, that has attracted a lot of angel capital. As far as I know, it's the biggest angel-funded company in the UK. I'm chairman there. And it's £8 million of venture capital, of angel capital.
So what capital? Angel?
Angel, yes. Yeah, so people like you, I pass my hat around and I say,
oh, I see.
Could I have, you know, a few bob and throw it in?
I see, yeah.
So personal investments by individuals. Some of them, you know, have quite a bit of firepower. You know, they put in a million, but nevertheless. Mm. And then the third one, it's just to illustrate this amazing spectrum, is a company called Real VNC. That's a software company, and it's a sort of amazing thing about the internet. So it's something that we open sourced originally because we were so busy doing all this other impact stuff that we just open sourced that one. We now run a company that sells a version of that stuff. This VNC technology is remote control. You can get it to another computer for control purposes easily. It's a graphics technology. It's the world's most popular technology for this. So there are, well, I don't know how many, but it's certainly at least 100 million, possibly more than 100 million licenses have been taken. I say possibly, you can't count, you know, we know how many went off this site, but who knows what's happening with this stuff. And profitable from the word go, we've kept it small, we've kept it deliberately what it is, it's growing fast, it's printing money, and it's very wholesome, and no capital, it's you know, it's no capital. We worked for nothing for a couple of years, but we didn't take any investment, it didn't take any investment, and this thing is everywhere, I'm just everywhere. Any seminar I give, if I want to just warm them up a little bit. Who's using VNC? Half the audience. Put their hand up. Not more than half. Or the techie audience. So
these are extraordinary, you know, they're all different. Mm. So the biggest, one of the biggest VC funded ones, one of the biggest angel funded ones, one of the biggest not funded by anything ones. And you know, it just happens, right? It just happens. And this is all in parallel to the university side. And you know, these two sides, people pay a lot of lip service, but actually I would say you can't double up. So I haven't doubled up and I don't work twice as hard. And actually there is a price to pay on both sides for doing the two. On the academic side, I think there isn't, and I'm not sure there should be, I don't know, but there isn't any particular accommodation that one is doing this sort of stuff, which actually I think is important for the university, but I don't think there's any particular, I had to change departments to get a chair, right? So there we go. And on the industrial side, you end up, as compared to leaving the university and being fully engaged with the company sort of indefinitely, again, you tend not to rise or go with it quite to the level that you could have done had you done it. Mm-hmm. So there are good things. You're sort of offsetting your risk and you're enjoying two different worlds. Also do farming, that's a completely different world, you know, whereas all grubbage kind of stuff, that's fine. So, you know, there's enjoyment of all that sort of stuff. And through the university, it's the non-techie friends, which are just as important as the techie friends. That's another dimension. But there is a price.
I was just going to, I mean, it's an astounding story. I just don't know how you managed to do, well, the three things, the air, the flying, obviously takes a lot of time, the university and the other, I mean.
Well, the flying is slightly sideways because that, in terms of actual time per week, isn't great, and it lines up with holidays and things like that. Yeah.
But how do you manage to do the other two things? I mean,
well, I don't know, it just happens. I don't have any method, I don't do anything different. I would just say that it's all about people. You surround yourself with good people, you delegate and you forget it. And you build a level of trust where the delegation works, and you know, on the long term, you win by doing that. So in the university, running the computer lab is sweet and lovely and takes no time at all, because first of all, compared to being the CEO of an industrial research lab, which has to find money, which has to commercialize, doing my own HR, doing my own everything, the computer lab is a double doddle, right? What's the problem? You know, blink and you've done it. So that's straightforward. Because there's not much. What are you supposed to do? You know, you can't do much about all sorts of things. Mm. So you can do one or two dimensions, and that doesn't take very long. On the industrial side,
well, do you do lecturing and teaching and PhD supervising?
Well, I've just done my 50th PhD students, and I think I have the biggest group of places. Yeah, but again, what's the problem? You know, I got whatever it is, 4 or 5 postdocs, lots of PhD students, all that, the whole machine works. But again, I have good postdocs, I have good students, what's the problem? And I'm not trying to prove myself against them, and they're not trying to prove themselves to me too much. It's a team play, right? So and this doesn't always gel well with the university system at large, not on Cambridge, where you've got a strong team group kind of thing. But that's what makes, you know. And then on the industrial side, I was only CEO of that one company. Mind you, I did that for 15, 16 years. So you just do it, I don't know. But there you've got resource to mitigate. So, you know, you've got money, you've got people. So you just have to use that to your advantage to make it possible to do it. Concentrate on the things, the contribution you can make. In my case, sniff out new things pretty well. So concentrate on that. And then concentrate on the bets you're making on those things. And then on the academic side, you know, again, it helps if you're participating in the academic side, both your immediate side and your pals around the university, now in congruent in cognitive disciplines rather than social side. So you've got kind of a radar screen out there where it's
not very likely that you'll miss something. You might not be able to do it, but you'll be aware of it. Right? So that's your broader university radar screen. You've got your immediate research group, which, if it's healthy, is producing results in the sense of academic results, papers, and trained people in particular with the right thing in their mind. You're participating in industry, big and small. So you've got a small company where you've got focus, but then you're working or are part of a multinational, so you're seeing how that world's going. And then you finally participate in the financial side, so you look at the tree and you see what sort of money's growing on that tree and what's bearing good fruit today on the capital side, capitalist capital side, what the market's like. So money, can I raise it? Angel funding, is it VC funding? Are the public markets, is this fashionable, is that fashionable? Or so then if you now just put that together, it's obvious.
Obvious to you.
Well, it is, because you've got the knowledge, right? It's like Fred Hasgo, you know, winning Mastermind or whatever it was, you know, the taxi driver. He's got the knowledge of a taxi driver, so to speak. So it's something in all that. But as I say, and I'm not in any way sort of reflecting badly or anything, I'm just commenting that you lose a little bit across this as well. So if one were to concentrate on any one thing, then it would be even, if I had concentrated on the firms, for example, I'd probably have a substantial firm, I'd be a big boss of, and there we go, whether it would be better or not, I don't know, but there is. Similarly on the academic side, if you start using some kind of measure like journal paper citations, then I don't come out very well at all.
I was wondering...
citations by other journals which are in the Thomson Directory. If you take me as a cited author, actually I'm a highly cited author, but if you take the more academic perspective on that, then not.
I mean, is Cambridge a good place for doing what you're doing?
It's getting less good, but it's still a very good place. It's getting less good because of the world we live in, so it's not necessarily Cambridge's fault. Government pressures, competitive pressures, and all that sort of stuff. So the wriggle room has reduced. So I was one of the wriggling type, right? And David Wheeler was, in that sense, he was in the wriggle room, and there's less wriggle room. So, and while I'm established, as they say, more than established, I'm past it, perhaps, a newcomer coming in, is confronted with the measurement situation as it is. So, for example, in my immediate research group, it's okay because they can cuddle up. My postdocs, I like to think, can cuddle up to me. I get the very best, and I fix consulting there. I get it's all sort of put together, and they're happy. But if not for that, they wouldn't exist in the university, and so that doesn't scale. So you can have a little pocket here, a little pocket there, but. There we go. So it'll be interesting how this develops in the next 10 or 20 years. And this is compounded by the subject moving on, where when I started, there weren't hundreds of companies and all that sort of stuff. Now there are. However, we're still in the university able to do stuff, but it just takes a little more thought. And so we have a theme in the computer lab in my own research, what I call in a slightly... populist way, computing for the future of the planet. Okay, so we have a theme, that's a sort of banner description of it, which actually has meaning, but it's also a banner. Future planet, good words, computing. But what it means is, what's the engineering approach, if you like, or operational approach, to solving some of the major problems, and what role does computing play in it, and indeed, is computing part of the solution in the sense that it's indispensable to solve some of these things? So if you imagine observing the world, the real physical world, using sensors in great detail and then using that data to optimize some energy cost or something, and then feeding that back as a pricing mechanism or just information, that might be an example of something like that. Or which is why I have links with Africa as well as this sort of technological thing. Because if you think of those developing countries, the platform they're going to have is the mobile phone of some kind, or the thing currently called a phone, it's the mobile computer. It may be that by enabling
much more wealth creation in that world, in cyberspace, based on mobiles, their standard of living will increase, and therefore their family size won't be quite on average as big as it is now because of better standard of living. And that's a method for dealing with population growth, or one of the methods, at least the one that I can do something about. So you can find lines like that, and that's a line which it's easier to do in a university, because even in a large company which has loads of money, like Google or Microsoft, even there, it would be at the periphery to say, well, I'm actually trying to develop platforms which will relate to the family size in Africa, right? I can say that with a straight face in a university situation, but I can't even in a very rich company research lab situation. So, I would say it's less appealing now. So there is a role for the university, but it's a little more along those lines. But we have that in the computer lab, and it's a theme, and leading the computer lab from behind, because it's very important for a head of department not to lead from in front, so to speak, to suggest, encourage, trap, so on, but never tell.
I like the word trap.
I snuck up on them.
Yeah. Is there
snuck
anything?
It up on them.
It's delightful, but I feel there's many more things one could discuss. But is there anything, any large area of your life which I have managed to miss?
That's my family.
Yes.
Tell so, me. Family is wife, Alison Smith, Plant Sciences Department. And her time is just coming. Not her person's coming in the sense that she's fine, but biofuels and how to really do it and what does it mean, and GMO organisms and growing things that are appropriate, new things that are appropriate for generating energy is one of the lines. And then two children aged 13 and 12.
And girls or boys?
A boy and a girl. Mm. And there we go. So that's...
And you manage
it.
All that as well.
that's in the... And a farm, as I say, so wheat and barley and words of garbage in Ulaa.
Really? You do all that as well?
Yeah, so 100-something acres, and it's proper farm where we flog this stuff and all that. But that's managing a farm, not farming, although I do have tractors. You know, that's back to the oil leak, oxygen, all that sort of...
What a phenomenon, if I may say so. Anyway, thank you very much indeed for a lovely interview.